Good afternoon, good morning, everyone. Welcome to today's session. Today's session is going to be around construction and COVID-19. We've got a lawyer's perspective and an expert witness perspective in today's session. My name is Paul Giles. I'm a partner at DLA Piper in the UK, and I lead the DLA UK Construction Engineering Disputes team. Over 20 years in the construction sector and specializing in all of that time with claims and live project support work. Martin will introduce himself momentarily, but we're going to cover today a few topics which hopefully will be of interest to you, commencing with the initial confusion and evolving position from COVID-19 in the sector in early 2020. We'll touch on force majeure and change in law. I will cover both of those sessions. Martin will then talk about the experiences that he has had with clients seeking advice from him on the delay side, talk about the assessment of delay and disruption. We'll then touch on subsequent waves, the second and third waves, and the impact they've had on the sector, and then summarise some of the legal issues to consider. So before we get going, Martin, would you like to introduce yourself?
Good morning, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Martin Hunter. I'm Managing Director and Co-Head of Yendo Hunter, based in London. I have over 30 years of experience in the construction sector, 20 of which I've acted as an independent expert witness in relation to delay and quantum issues. Thank you.
So if we get started on the first topic to cover today, we wanted to talk a little bit about what happened initially when COVID hit. And so for most parts of the world, that was early 2020, and in the UK in particular, probably March, late February, early March 2020. So the initial phase is probably one of confusion, I have badged it. COVID hit, there was a lockdown imposed upon most of the country in the construction sector, like many parts of the economy. Initially, was a little bit uncertain as to how that affected them and what to do as a result of the legal position. The reality is that whole sort of 3 to 4 weeks from mid-March to mid to late April was really characterized by confusion. Most of the economy shut down. Construction was treated slightly separately from the rest of the economy, but there was a real lack of clear guidance. So what happened is companies took the decisions or the lack of clarity into their own hands and made decisions about what they thought was best for their own individual circumstances. In the most part, that meant that most construction sites in the UK probably shut down for a couple of weeks. Some continued, but most shut down for a couple of weeks. And there was a real thirst, I think, for clear guidance from the government. The effect of site shutdowns is pretty obvious, really. There was no work going on in that initial phase period, and the supply chain as a whole, and I think particularly the smaller subcontractors, took decisions to try to protect their people as best that they could, and they understood that to be stopping work. That, I think, practical side of things very quickly led into questions over contract. What is the contractual position and what should the construction industry be doing to protect its position? That feeds into the first two real legal points that I'm going to talk about, which is force majeure and change in law. Before I get to that, just to underscore what the legal position actually was, from the start of the initial lockdown in England, and beyond, and continued to be the position through the various lockdowns that have occurred over the last year. And that was that construction work can continue if done in accordance with social distancing guidelines wherever possible. Now that is perhaps still a little bit uncertain in some areas. What does the wherever possible mean? But the general guidance is construction work can continue. And of course, as we've seen over the past year, many construction companies have adapted their working models to make sure that social distancing does take place wherever it can possibly do. I think the key thing to note in that first month or 6 weeks or so was that that clarity that now exists, when we can look back and say that clarity, what it was, it didn't apply at the time. There was an awful lot of confusion, and we had organizations such as the Construction Leadership Council get involved to try and clarify the position for the construction sector. To add to the confusion, within the UK, and we'll talk about international projects a bit later, but within the UK, you also had the devolved governments in Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland, for that matter, who all imposed slightly different legal regimes or different guidance as to what should take place when. The differences between the different countries, you know, could be the source of a webinar itself. So I'm going to try and focus on the English law position, but just recognise throughout that the position is slightly different in Scotland, slightly different in Wales and Northern Ireland as well. So in that initial phase, and if we move to the next slide, please. So in that initial phase, the very first reaction of the construction sector, I think, was, well, there must be a force majeure event. And if everyone went to check their contracts and look at the provisions, and sure enough, I think many of the force majeure clauses in both domestic and international contracts where English law applies would have some reference to either epidemic or pandemic or events similar to that. And I think the general contracting world latched onto that, identified that there was a potential for a force majeure event, that this was in the phase, of course, where there was the confusion and site shutdown in many places. And so there was a need to try and protect the contractual position for a position that no one really knew at that time how long those site shutdowns would continue. And so there was a rush to notify the force majeure events, or at least to recognize there was a force majeure event and try to notify the owners or employers. Now, whether or not there was a force majeure event in reality, and what the impact of that force majeure event took place is a question of a bit more detail. We're going to touch on that in a minute. The key event that took place, I think, in that early phase, though, was that irrespective of what the contract said in terms of the force majeure test, contractors and subcontractors all rushed to issue their notices. And if they didn't, they should have done, to issue their notices around force majeure events occurring, and claimed that there was some form of delay as a result. This sort of event, I suppose it's worth noting, although it's quite kind of obvious, had obviously not happened in the construction sector before, certainly in my period of practicing in this area, and indeed probably for, I guess, 100 years or so since the Spanish flu in early 20th century. The FM force majeure notification took place, and the question then really was, well, was there a force majeure event? Just because the contracts identified that there was an epidemic or a pandemic type event, did that mean there was really a force majeure event that gave rise to some sort of relief? And this was the key point, I think, in relation to force majeure, which is the occurrence of a force majeure event. So very often an issue around war, terrorism, any of those sort of incredibly unusual events that could impact a construction site tend to fit into the usual definitions of force majeure. So the event certainly of a pandemic, a global pandemic, kind of fits into those general descriptions. It wouldn't fit into all descriptions in the force majeure clauses, and some of them are non-specific in identifying the type of events. But assuming the pandemic, epidemic, fitted into the force majeure event in the particular contract, then that's only one part of the story contractually. There also needed to be an impact of that force majeure event that tended to result in a suspension generally of the works in their entirety, or if there was specific wording in a contract in relation to a part or parts of the works. So there is a twofold test really in relation to force majeure in most of the English law contracts. Firstly, has an event happened? And secondly, what's the impact of that event? Has it actually caused, in most circumstances, a suspension of the works because of that event occurring? And it's really important to note and underscore that in relation to force majeure, there's no general concept of force majeure in English law like there are in some civil code territories. And so the test that must be applied is the test that's set out in the contract. So you have to work through the step-by-step test in relation to force majeure in the contract to see whether or not it applied to the specific circumstances. So what we had with the initial phase then of COVID-19 pandemic is certainly a theoretical force majeure event in almost all circumstances. I think both employers and contractors would recognize that because this global pandemic emerged, which clearly had the potential to impact construction works. But then you've got that slight juxtaposition against, in the UK, a government that's saying, no need to stop work, no need to stop construction works, please do carry on. So would there naturally have been an event that caused the suspension or caused a significant delay to parts or all of the works? That certainly becomes a significant question as we move on to trying to assess the impact of these force majeure events that were notified initially. And again, I said earlier, you know, the approach in Scotland versus the approach in England and Wales was different. The approach across Europe was quite different. And so it would very much depend upon your contract and your jurisdiction in terms of whether or not you have this force majeure event that would give rise to some sort of entitlement. So as we move on into change in law and the next phase of the COVID pandemic, next slide, please. As we move on to the next phase of the COVID-19 pandemic, as things had settled down in the UK a little bit, construction industry had issued all of the relevant force majeure notices, and probably in some cases put forward some generic claims as to the time and cost impacts of force majeure, then I think it became clear that as the lockdown and the impact of lockdowns in the UK and again England, Scotland, Wales all dealing with this differently, as the government started to issue legal guidance, the lawyers, the contractors, and the employers all became aware of this next phase in the contractual picture, which is a rush to the change in law notice. Now, one of the key themes of force majeure entitlement, generally speaking, is that force majeure gives rise to time entitlement, so relief from delay, but not necessarily cost entitlement. Change in law, generally speaking, would give you both time and money entitlement if a change in law event has occurred. So the appeal for particularly the contracting world is that, or was that the force majeure notices and force majeure events, which the pandemic clearly fit into, might give them time relief, but might not give them cost relief. So change in law much more attractive because it had the time and money element to it. So the next phase that came probably May, June, July was the change in law notices, where the contractors were issuing the same notices in the change in law substance as they were in relation to the force majeure substance, i.e., it was the same subject matter, the pandemic, that gave rise to the entitlement of force majeure as gave rise to the change in law. And Martin, we might discuss that in a bit in terms of that dual contractual entitlement and how contractors have been dealt with, have been dealing with those sorts of claims. So the position around change in law is hugely complicated. Whether or not there have been actual changes in law in England, Scotland, and Wales, and when those changes in law came in will be key to tracking entitlement and the change in law provisions in the construction contracts. In some jurisdictions, we had guidance issued by governments as opposed to legal directives issued by governments. In the UK alone, we had 64 changes in the regulations within a 9-month period after March 2020. So you can see the complexity in trying to track those changes in law and how they may apply to construction sites, because ultimately, as I think Martin will talk about, the fact that these events have occurred almost outside of the construction sector itself doesn't necessarily mean there is some entitlement. It is still a question of fact. Was there some delay? Was there some cost incurred as a result? An interesting point, just to note around the change in law position, is the impact on foreign supply chains. We have quite an integrated European, but certainly international supply chain that works with the UK construction sector. And in the different countries throughout Europe and the world, different legal rules applied. So in China, for example, there was a very severe lockdown initially. In Sweden, there was no real lockdown at all. So you've got a wide range of legal issues that could impact the construction work that was ongoing. And perhaps most importantly, then one needs to look at the construction contract to understand whether or not the change in law provision would apply only to the area where the site was, the country where the site was. So if your site was in London, for example, would the change in law provision only apply to the UK where that site was, or could it be stretched to apply to a country in Europe where there was a more severe lockdown and which caused a delay to the works because supply chains were shut down and massively delayed as a result of changes in law in those specific jurisdictions. That's quite, again, a difficult issue because one is not only looking at what's happening in English law or UK law to the project itself, but also potentially many different countries and what has happened to the law in those countries that might have impacted the site and the site works. We have had examples at DLA where we've had Russian clients working with an Italian and Indian joint venture, and trying to assess entitlement by reference to the numerous changes in law that took place in Italy and took place in India, and the impact that had on the site works has been really quite an extensive and hugely complicated exercise. But clearly, the point that I made in relation to force majeure applies in relation to changes in law as well. It's all very well being able to identify a change in law, but the critical issue is what is the impact of that change in law upon the project itself. Now, the two key themes that came out in that early period of 2020 when COVID-19 hit were force majeure and change in law. Those aren't the only two contractual areas that the construction sector looked at to consider relief. There were other areas such as the health and safety laws and how they might apply, how they would be dealt with by the local authorities. And so it's important to consider the contract as a whole. But in today's session, I wanted to just cover that the force majeure and change in law point. And then to talk about that initial period and conclude that initial period. And if we go to the next slide, please. So in that initial period, there were a few key themes that I think arose from that rush to force majeure and then the change in law position. And that was, firstly, that there were plenty of claims produced to varying different levels of detail. I'm sure Martin would touch on that as well. But there were very few formal proceedings. There were, as far as we were aware, only there was one adjudication, I think, in the UK in the first 7 months post March 2020, which dealt with COVID themes. That was actually in Scotland. There may well have been others, but the point is there were very few formal proceedings on the back of that because the legal position was so uncertain, the contractual position was so uncertain. As a result, there were obviously a lot of unresolved claims, and that does seem to be an issue that is ongoing even now, a year further on, that those claims have not necessarily been resolved, and they may well still be going through a negotiation process, which will either conclude favourably or not, and we might see in due course some more formal disputes arising out of those negotiations that just don't come to a successful conclusion. The critical point to note in relation to the claims is, I think, that the relief that a contractor seeks in relation to force majeure is generally different and under a different set of contractual rules to the relief that a contractor seeks under a change in law. And so there needs to be a choice, if you like, by the contractor as to which relief it's really seeking and which relief it says applies, because the consequences of the relief it's seeking is different. And that is one of the key problems for a contractor in this scenario, is that if you give up force majeure, if you give up change in law, you potentially give up some of your relief, but you have to kind of choose one because they are generally two different regimes, certainly in the international contracts, the FIDIC type contracts. With that structure, there are different regimes, but equally in the JCT in English law, they are different entitlements and different claims to present. Another theme that then arose from that early period was the labour and material shortages. I talked about the impact on the supply chain, and that was quite dramatic, I think, in the first month or two, and then just became a bit more problematic over the months as there was disruption to the supply chain, I think, generally. Martin will talk more about the causation issue, but it relates to that point I just talked about. What is the actual relief that is being sought, and how do contractors and employers deal with that. But overwhelming theme from that initial period was that negotiation compromise was going on. Employers in particular seemed to be willing to entertain contractor claims, seemed to be willing to try and come to some sort of arrangement to try and resolve the additional cost and delay that may have occurred as a result of COVID-19. At this stage, I was then going to pass to Martin. So, Martin, your experiences in that initial period of COVID, if you would share those, and then lead us into how you have, or one should, look at the assessment of delay and disruption.
Thanks, Paul. As a firm, over the last year or so, we've been approached by a number of clients, both owner and contractor, who are looking for advice in respect to COVID matters. And those matters could be on contracts that are in the initial phases or well on, but are ongoing. They could also be in relation to projects that are complete or almost complete. And so the COVID issues are being addressed retrospectively in conjunction with other delaying events on that project. Bearing in mind, COVID is just another delaying event on these projects. We've looked at projects in a multitude of jurisdictions globally. And in doing so, we've had to deal with a number of different types of contract provisions. Paul has already addressed some of those provisions, and they'll obviously change depending on the country where the events are being assessed, both in relation to contract and also local jurisdictions. Moving on to my next slide. So whilst COVID is perhaps seen as a potentially single continuing event, there's obviously a myriad of issues that could potentially arise from COVID itself. Given there are so many issues, what I'll try to do today is maybe look at things from a more generic standpoint, focusing on delay and disruption. I'm not going to address quantum, but clearly entitlement to quantum would be driven by the contract provisions themselves, as well as good practice in terms of assessment of quantum. But looking at delay first, analysing delay on projects where there's been a COVID event, the types of techniques that would be employed would be no different in assessing delay on any other project. The first port of call would obviously be to look at the contract provisions to understand if there's any method of analysis that's prescribed under the contract. It may well be the contract prescribes a prospective type of analysis, or indeed a retrospective type of analysis might be permitted. But what I would say is, you know, whatever method of analysis that's employed, it's employed in accordance with obviously best practice. And best practice, would seek to assess delay both, you know, driven by common sense and driven by the facts, to get, you know, the context of why it is these events are said to have caused the impact claimed by the contractor. One of the issues that, you know, we see generally across all projects and would certainly apply to assessing delay in respect to COVID is if one is looking to try and assess delay prospectively, then that obviously requires very specific information to be available, both in terms of programming information and also progress information that we know from experience on major projects globally. Sometimes the contemporaneous programs produced on these projects are well compiled, well constructed, and regularly and accurately updated. However, we also know that there are generally problems with the completion of programs on large projects. And so one should not blindly apply the programs, or one should not try to amend the programs either. One has to take a very common sense view if one is going to use contemporaneous programs, and also and always sense check those programs in terms of what's actually going on the project, both in terms of as-built information as well as progress information. And so, you know, up-to-date progress information will be key if one is to look at things prospectively. If we move to the next slide. So when we're looking at, you know, the available program information and what's been going on the project, and when we're looking to assess delay, we obviously want to see what program or what programs were in play at the time of the event. And obviously at the outset, try to establish a baseline, which has been approved by the parties against which to measure delay against, and also any program updates agreed thereafter. We're obviously looking to establish what activity or what activities were on the critical path prior to the COVID event, and establish, important to establish the state of the progress of the project immediately before the impact of COVID, and then understand how the delay accrued after the event. Go back to the point I made about a myriad of issues could arrive from the one event, which is COVID. You obviously, and we'll come on to this in a bit more detail, certain things could happen down the line, which makes other things critical. And so because COVID is a continuing event, it may well be that the critical path over time changes. It may well be that at the point in time the COVID event started, perhaps in early 2020, that site-specific activities were on the critical path. However, due to closure of manufacturing facilities at different times through this whole event, off-site matters became more critical, and that may well change depending on the availability of certain materials or equipment that were being manufactured off-site and had to be shipped to the project. And we know that dealing with large and complex infrastructure projects globally, that the materials and equipment are manufactured all over the world and shipped to site. So the impact of the COVID event could change dramatically, depending on, as Paul was saying, decisions made, change of law in other jurisdictions and other countries where materials are being produced. When we're looking at assessing what the impact of the event was, we're looking to assess the expected or estimated duration of that impact at the time the event occurs. When we assess delay, we're looking to assess delay as it accrues over time. And whilst it may well be the case that further down the line, later in the project, mitigation procedures are put in place to reduce the impact of delays, not only COVID, but other events later that happened earlier in the project. Those events should be taken into account at those times those events are put in place, not with the benefit of hindsight, if that's what one tries to do in respect to the COVID events. You're looking to assess the impact of the delay at the time the delay is said to have impacted. Maybe move to the next slide. One of the things that we've seen when we're analysing delay and we're dealing with the positions of the various parties on projects is, given it's such a, this has been such a huge, such an event in the construction world, we're often seeing issues of concurrency argued in defence of claims driven by, or what's said to be driven by, COVID. So again, when we're looking at concurrency, the first port of call, like in analysing delays, to look at what the contract says. What does the contract say in terms of how we should deal with concurrency? And that's still step one. The most important step in my experience in terms of assessing concurrency is understanding the extent to which, if at all, there was truly critical concurrent delay. To what extent might it be argued the project would always have been in delay regardless of the COVID event? And that's an issue of fact and analysing fact and looking at the project in the context of the various events, both COVID and other issues that are said to be impacting the project, and taking a common sense view of what the position of the project was at different points in time through this COVID event. And that no doubt will be looking at critical events as well as non-critical events. But again, you know, when assessing concurrency as well as contractual issues, one of the most important things we need to look at in the context of when these events are said to be critical, you know, what, where are these other potentially concurrent events truly critical? If you move on to the next slide. One of the things that we've seen arising in the various matters that we've looked at globally is our claims for disruption, inefficient working, impacting the efficiency of the project due to the COVID event. Now, as we know, a disruption could be driven by both critical and non-critical events. And we could see reduced productivity on site due to social distancing with reduced resources on site. We could see reduced productivity on site due to an inability to employ skilled labour. And we know on major infrastructure projects globally, they rely not only materials and equipment from overseas, but also labour. And the ability to source that labour may have been impacted by the COVID event, which may again change depending on the circumstances in the country where that labour is being sourced. So those are things that are going to have to be analysed, you know, throughout this whole process to understand the effect, if at all, that that's had on the progress of the works and the extent to which it's disrupted the progress of the works. And I've mentioned the potential lack of materials and equipment, which impacts the supply issues on the project, which may also disrupt the progress of the works and lead to inefficient working. We know from experience, both in terms of dealing with working with contractors who've got disruption claims and defending disruption claims, they are notoriously difficult to assess. But just like any good delay analysis, a good disruption analysis, not only just in respect to COVID, but any issue, is one that's fact-based, common sense-driven, looking at productivity prior to the event that's being assessed, and looking at productivity post the event to understand the extent to which, if at all, the COVID event and or perhaps other events have impacted the productivity during the period that's being assessed. So that's really all I wanted to say on delay and disruption. I mean, I've addressed this in a very generic sense. There are so many component parts arising from construction, from COVID, that could impact and progress and impact both from a delay perspective and a disruptive perspective. But I'm just trying to deal with that in a generic sense. I'll hand back to Paul now.
Thanks, Martin. Before we let you off the hook, I wondered whether there was just a couple of points we could discuss in terms of what you'd shared with us there, Martin. It seems to me, so if we assume contractors tick their contractual boxes in terms of getting the right notices in place, whether it's force majeure or change in law, there are always going to be some jurisdictions where the construction industry was genuinely shut down by the government when COVID first hit. And it seems also that there's a certain period of time whilst those countries and contractors worked out how they were able to work safely post-COVID. And so you might have an initial period in those certain countries where there might be a potential delay, which, as you said, I think in your session, would depend upon where the critical path was and what was happening at that particular time. But in those countries where there isn't that absolute shutdown or that legally enforced shutdown, a lot of the impact of COVID, if you take the UK as an example, or in England, where the construction industry was not shut down and indeed was encouraged to continue to work, a lot of the impact seems to be more likely to sit on the disruption side rather than the delay side. You know, the social distancing measures you talked about, they're clearly going to have an impact, the effect on supply chain, maybe both inside and outside the UK. And have you seen then that in the claims that you've looked at where perhaps initially delay claims have turned into productivity claims? Or, I mean, what experience have you got of that?
I think generally speaking, in terms of the matters that we've looked at, the focus has been on the delay side of things. looking at the impact of these events, as you say, initially to understand what the initial impact of these events were, and then also looking at the ongoing impact of these events. I think, suppose in many ways, what contractors and clients, owners have been trying to understand is, you know, what the kind of long-term impact of this could be. We've seen projects where the long-term impact has been projected fairly early on, which has subsequently been reduced due to mitigation efforts that have been put in place later on, once people have got their heads around what this all might mean and how it might be dealt with in a more perhaps efficient way. And go back to your point, Paul, about you know, people were somewhat, you know, in the dark when this all kicked off. And so when clarity was provided on a, I suppose, sort of piecemeal basis as this progressed, people were able to understand and project going forward what the true impact of this might be and what mitigation efforts might be put in place to assess that, sorry, to mitigate that. In terms of disruption, we've seen some disruption claims. Nothing has been, that I've seen, put forward on what I would call a proper analytical basis. It's more been people putting notices in, as you say, and trying to sort of estimate what it might be at a fairly high level. But at the moment, you know, I certainly haven't seen any well-progressed disruption claims that have been progressed. But that's not to say, and certainly won't be the case, that we will see that, no doubt, as this progresses.
So I think that's the theme that we've seen as well, which is whether or not it's the impact and projected delay on a project as a whole, or the potential impact of disruption. The claims, certainly, that we've seen from when we've been acting for employer, that we've seen from contractor side, you would say, are not as well developed as perhaps they should be. And from experience working with contractors, there seems to be a lot of work left to do to get them to the relevant sort of standard if you were going to go into formal claim scenario, which I guess is where you guys would come in. But as I mentioned at the outset, it also seems there is a willingness to try and work through some of these problems, that even if the claims aren't well developed, there is some recognition that this whole COVID mess has really had an impact upon the sector as a whole, I think.
No, absolutely. And I think one of the key things, in terms of going back to the point I made about you know, dealing with things at the time, you can only plan and project manage your project based on what's in front of you. You don't have a crystal ball to look into and understand what might happen a year from now. And so, you know, looking at the contract provisions, perhaps, and looking at what the contract says about how delay should be assessed and when it should be assessed during the duration of the project, you know, it may well be beneficial, for example, for an owner to, if you like, kick the can down the road a bit to see what happens in 12 to 18 months time, and then assess it then with the benefit of all the information at that time. But very often that's not how the contract, you know, asks you to analyze these, or requires you to analyze these things, which is my point about, you know, these events, you know, where the contract says it should be analyzed based on what's known at that time. If subsequently you know, mitigation efforts or changes in sequence of working or changes to the project itself are put in place that reduce the impact of that, then that would be a benefit to the accrual of delay later on in the project, but not at the time when we were assessing the delay in the first place.
It's the age-old point of tension between contractor and the employer there, where contractor would often favour the prospective analysis at the time, and the engineer or employer might like to see how things work out before making a significant decision. And with COVID, I mean, what do you base that projection on is the key question, I suppose.
But the point being, COVID impacted so many live projects, you know, long before they were due to be completed. So that, you know, and again, you know, the guidance on the contract provisions will be essential as to how delay should be assessed. But again, you know, you're looking at things always with an eye to coming up with an assessment that's based on common sense and fact, you know, with reference to all the information available at that time.
Okay. That discussion is a reasonably good segue into the next section, where I was just going to touch on some subsequent waves. I was going to call this session second waves, but actually some countries in the world are into their second and third and maybe even fourth waves. And it seems like that pattern is going to continue going forwards. So next slide, please. So in respect of the second and third waves, from a contractual perspective, I thought it was worth just talking about what the position was when that second and third waves hits. Martin's talked about COVID kind of being an ongoing event generally, which clearly it is. You know, it's not gone away in at any stage in the last year, pretty much in whichever jurisdiction you are in the world. But then we've seen changes in the economic outlook, whether we're all in lockdown or not in lockdown, as the country's been released from lockdown and then gone back into second lockdown, third lockdown, maybe even fourth lockdown in the UK. And the waves of the virus have been on the rise. What impact does that have on your construction contract? Well, the position, as I talked about in relation to force majeure and changing law, is really the same with a second and third wave. Is there a force majeure event? Is there a change in law event? Same factors apply there. I suppose the key question is, have you already notified of that event? When you notified of your initial force majeure event in early 2020, when the second wave or third wave hits in late 2020, early 2021. I think my answer to that is, well, maybe it's an ongoing event. But if you're the contractor in that scenario, you probably want to refresh your notices, issue new notices to say, well, there's potential new entitlement arising out of this second wave, third wave. If, of course, there is a new event, the new change in law, the new guidance that impacts your site, that creates that lockdown scenario, or that creates that pandemic or epidemic scenario for force majeure. I don't know, Martin, whether you had any thoughts on that in terms of what you've seen with the analysis. Because have you looked at analysis over the initial phase, the first wave, if you like, and then how have you dealt with things differently with second and third waves?
As I said, I think you know, this is an ongoing event, and there could be a myriad of issues that arise out of COVID, which will evolve as these projects move forward. So you know, things could change based on when you're actually doing the analysis. So up until now, we've certainly seen claims come through the initial phases of COVID, through the first wave, both in terms of projects in the UK and outside of the UK. We're beginning now to see the potential impact of these second and third waves coming through as well, and advising on those as well. But again, that's just a matter of analysis, looking at these delays in the context of the project at the time to understand the impact, if any, that they're having on the progress of the works.
Yeah. Just a note at this point as well, I think that generally speaking, I'm a disputes lawyer, so we tend to see the problems that arise, and Martin's expert witness, so tend to see the problems that arise on existing construction projects. So what I understand our transactional colleagues have started to deal with is that once COVID arose, we started to see COVID-type clauses being inserted into contracts for new projects. So a lot of the issues with the second and third waves that we've just talked about arise in relation to the long-running construction projects that have been in place for some time, perhaps in relation to contracts that have been placed after COVID first arose this time last year, there are additional provisions in the contract that deal specifically with the allegation allocation of time and money. Have you seen anything of that, Martin, at this stage? It's perhaps too early for you to have seen any of those COVID type clauses.
No, I haven't seen any of that at this stage, Paul.
Yeah. That will probably take some time to come through before it hits my desk or your desk, Martin, because obviously the problems need to hit, and then we need to see what the contracts say, and hopefully the impact of these subsequent waves and COVID will start to subside, but it may well be an ongoing problem for some time. But just key point there, I think, is note that if you've got a post March 2020 contract, then you need to redouble your efforts just to check that there hasn't been something specifically inserted in relation to the impact of COVID that would change those points that we talked about in relation to force majeure, change in law, entitlement. And so moving on to the next slide. And so just to wrap up on some of the key legal issues arising from the session today, I think starting point as ever is to check the contract. What does the contract say around your particular entitlement, and where can you identify that potential claim scenario? Is it through force majeure? Is it change in law? Or is it some other provision, perhaps relating to health and safety? The mechanisms in most English law contracts are not totally straightforward in relation to force majeure and change in law, and you need to track through the tests for each of those provisions before identifying there is a potential claim scenario on whichever side of the supply chain you're at. Obviously, most modern contracts in the UK and English law contracts abroad include provisions relating to condition precedents and time bars, i.e. notification within a certain period after an event arises. And very important to check that too. I talked a little bit earlier about the willingness of owners, employers to negotiate entitlement. I think that's definitely true, but if you're the contractor, you don't want to put yourself in a position where you have potentially missed out on your entitlement because of a failure to notify. That may well also apply in relation to second, third, and subsequent waves. And so taking a safety first approach of making sure the notifications are in place makes eminent sense when new waves, new changes in law, new guidance are all issued. And then to the events. So Martin's particular focus today has been around what is the actual impact of the delays and all the disruptions when they hit. And that can be some quite complicated analysis, understanding of the facts, and involves, as Martin said, some projections. I don't know whether you want to touch on that just to summarize, Martin.
No, I think the point there, Paul, is that, you know, obviously, particularly where projects are ongoing, is we can only assess based on the information available at the time what the impact or the projected impact is estimated to be. And that's what one should be looking to assess at the point in time. As I say, you know, hindsight, you know, is a great thing, but we don't have the benefit of hindsight when people are trying to manage projects going forward. So that's why we should be assessing what the impact, if the project's ongoing, what the impact or the estimated impact of that was at that time.
Yeah. Thanks. And then just to close, one of the key consequences, particularly in relation to force majeure, less likely in relation to change in law, is that if a force majeure event has been identified and if a suspension of the works has taken place, most contracts, English law contracts, now include an escalation of the consequences of that, leading towards termination after a certain period of suspension. So very important just to look out for that. It's not necessarily going to apply for all the reasons that we've touched on today, particularly in the UK, where force majeure is less likely to apply simply because the government has tried to push the construction sector to continue to be active. So it is a potential consequence, and it is a different consequence than would apply in the situation of change in law, but something to watch out for there. I don't know, Martin, whether you have anything else to say in closing, but that, I think that was it from our session today.
No, I had nothing else, Paul. Thanks very much.
No, thanks for your time and valuable expert input. And that brings to today's session to a close. Thank you very much, everyone.